Welcome to Comics in Conversation, everyone. My name is Jordan Calhoun with our guest, creator of the award-nominated comic As the Crow Flies, Melanie Gilman. Welcome
Thanks
to the show,
having
Melanie.
Me.
Such a pleasure to have you. I've been looking forward to this for a while now. So first, let's start off talking about the Eisner Award. Sort of tell me how that experience was for you and submitting. Were you completely surprised you got the nomination? What were the emotions going on there?
Oh, gosh. Emotions all over the place. I'm not even certain who or what submitted me that.
Didn't do it?
No, it wasn't me. I just got an email back in, I guess it was April or something, completely out of the blue. I think I was like at the middle of grading student papers or something like that. I'm a professor at a local art college to help support my comics habit. But yeah, I think I was in the middle of grading and suddenly this email on my phone, like, congratulations, you've been nominated for like literally the highest award.
That is amazing. That must have come as even a bigger surprise. Who did you tell? Like what happened when you got that email? Did you think it was a prank?
The thought crossed my mind, but luckily it wasn't. And the sad part too is that one of the things they always tell you when you get those emails about nominations is they're like, congratulations, here's awesome news. Now don't you tell anyone until you send the press release out, and it won't be for another like week or so. So you can spend this terrible agonizing week where you're sitting on this amazing news and can't talk to anybody about it. I think I did at least text my mom about it because, you know.
We won't tell the people at Eisner that secret.
They're going to revoke my nomination.
Exactly. They're just taken as the crow flies off the list. Melanie clearly can't keep secrets.
Yeah. Breach of confidentiality.
That's right. So let's dive into As the Crow Flies. I know a lot of people are going to be listening to this and maybe haven't read it yet, or they might not be familiar with it. So how would you describe this webcomic to someone who's unfamiliar?
As the Crow Flies is a webcomic that follows a group of queer teens who meet in very clearly a welcoming space to queer teens, meaning a Christian youth backpacking camp. So they get to deal with learning to navigate how to keep themselves safe and also keep the other people within their community, the community of little queer kids within this Christian youth camp, how to keep each other safe and support each other in what is actually a legitimately dangerous environment for them, a place which is not very queer friendly, also not very friendly to people of color or trans people, but also thinks of itself as being very open-minded and social justice oriented. One of the premises of the camp is that it's actually a feminist Christian youth camp, which is, I should say, in real life, this would be an extremely unusual thing. But for the purposes of the comic, I did want to talk a good bit about both the way that Christian spaces treat queer people and people of color as well as feminist spaces too. So I kind of smushed them into the same thing there. And it's the comic is drawn entirely in colored pencil, which is somewhat unusual in the comics world. I've been working on it for about 3 years now. I think it's up to page 207. So fairly long running, and still is quite a ways to go. It's probably about at the halfway point in the story right now.
So there's so many different things that I want to unpack there. I was going to ask if you had an ending already planned for it and how much was left, but you already answered that. So as a reader, I must say that there were so many different scenes that I thought you did a really excellent job, very subtly showing how Charlie, or how a queer person of color especially responds to sort of the subtleties that people say or that they see in places that other people might not realize can be troubling. So, for example, very early on in the comic, when Charlie, the protagonist, is checking in to camp, and there's a scene where they look to the side and see just a picture of just happy white Jesus with just white kids crawling all over him. and they look sort of unsettled not really unsettled, but just the fact that that scene was there and she's looking up at this picture, that was one of several scenes that just gave me as a reader so many feels, because I remember that, just always seeing pictures of white Jesus with a white lamb.
Yeah, and what that communicates to them too about is this actually a safe space for you? Is this actually going to be a welcoming and supportive space? Maybe not if they're not even questioning like the clearly incorrect racial stylings of Christ that they're putting on their walls. So yes, and again, a lot of this does have to do with microaggressions in a way. Charlie's dealing with a whole lot of microaggressions that are coming from the camp counselors, from the structure of the camp itself, from the other campers. And I do think that even things may function as a form of microaggressions in that manner.
Definitely, definitely. And even just the use of language when the camp's counselor says, you know, we're going to be purified. We are going to be whitened or something along those lines. And Charlie just pauses like, what?
Yeah. And does the thing where you look around and try to see, did anyone else?
Oh, that was, that is the best because that is a perfect description in my opinion of sort of what goes through everyone's mind when they notice something that they think is off and they wonder if they're crazy or if everyone else is crazy. And they're like, there was a moment where she's looking around and like, so are we going to talk about this or nah? And then the conversation kept going. She's like, all right, well, I should probably say something. Well, they're talking about the backpacks now. It was too late. I've been thinking about it too long.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of this story, too, is about Charlie, who is she's a little bit of an introverted person and kind of tends to keep to herself as a character. And a lot of this is about her particularly learning to navigate how do you actually build up that bravery to both speak up for yourself but also speak up quickly for yourself so you don't lose track of that moment as it is quickly escaping you. It's one of the reasons why I think that the dynamic between her and Sydney is particularly fun to work with. Sydney being she's a white trans girl who becomes Charlie's best friend over the course of the camp. And the two kind of bond together because they're both sharing experiences in different forms of the types of microaggressions and discriminations that are happening in this, you know, Christian, supposedly feminist space. And Sydney is quite a bit more quick on the draw and a little bit less inhibited than Charlie.
Yeah, she's the Spitfire.
She's the Spitfire, definitely. And yeah, it's been fun to work with the dialogue between the two of them because they both of them are learning from each other in different ways. And that's been a fun kind of subtle thread throughout their relationship that I've been really enjoying working on.
Can you describe how you came up with these characters and how much of it came from either your own personal experience or people that you knew or what got you to write on this topic and develop the characters the way that you did?
It came from a whole bunch of different directions. For full disclosure's sake, I was raised Christian and I did. Christian youth camp was a part of my childhood for basically every summer when I was growing up.
You and me both, Melanie.
So I did.
That's why this comic brought out all the feels. There were so many feels.
So we both got to have those fun, like, oh boy, it's time for summertime alienation again. So there is a good deal of this that is speaking from some amount of personal experience, though the story is itself a fiction story. I'm not just like no character is a direct stand-in for myself, and none of the things that are happening in the story are things which correlate to specific memories that I have or like one specific summer at this one particular camp. It's more a synthesis of things that happened to me, stories that I heard from friends or from like following blogs of people. So kind of a collection of different sources and then synthesizing them together into a singular narrative, which I hope will have enough things in it that people can actually relate to them and be able to point to it and be like, oh gosh, I went through that, or I remember something really similar to this. And as for the characters themselves, I guess it might be not totally correct to say that none of them are direct translations of yourself. I think that if you smushed Charlie and Sydney together somehow, you'd actually get a fairly accurate representation of my personality. In a way, when I was developing their characters, I was thinking a lot about the kind of kid that I was at this age, and I kind of had the two dueling natures of the Spitfire on one end and the quiet
the reserved
and more,
introvert on the other.
The reserved introvert who's very concerned about very concerned about questions of identity in particular and for making yourself a target in group situations. So I kind of divided those two hemispheres of my brain in a way into these two characters. And the rest of the people, they're kind of a synthesis of people that I remember from the camps, also people that I grew up with, family members, friends. I do think that in general, when you're doing character development, it's a good idea to try to ground characters in maybe not wholesale, like, you don't want to just be like, and Aunt Jenny over here is obviously this person 100%, just because that could be a little bit creepy for Aunt Jenny. But if you take different aspects of different people who you know and put them into your characters, you're going to tend to get a little bit more rich and realistic character development. It also helps to make sure that you've got a diverse array of different character types with different mannerisms, different speech patterns, different gestures, different postures, all those little details kind of coalesce in each character that you build. And if you can base more of them on people who are not yourself, you'll tend to get more interesting and more layered characters out of it. So it's definitely something that I recommend, especially for people who are interested in doing long form narratives like these. It's really crucial that all your characters be easily distinguishable and kind of all have their own little quirks.
Totally, totally. And did you come up with these quirks as you were writing the comic, or did you have character descriptions already written out before you even began the story?
A combination of both, actually. I did spend a good deal of time developing each of the characters in the book, you know, focusing a little bit more on the central characters, but I definitely know the side characters very well, even if they don't show up all that often. So I spent a good time before I actually started drawing any of the pages, just focusing on figuring out who these people were. But the interesting thing about writing long fiction like this, and again, I've been working on this book for 3-ish years now, you learn a ton of things about your characters just by the process of actively writing about them and exploring them in the, over the course of the book that you're working on. Some people get kind of freaked out by that. I try to embrace it because I think that that's a, it's a mark of me understanding the story on a deeper level, and also that the that I'm growing as a writer even over the course of me creating this book. I'm a big proponent of the idea that really you never stop learning, and there's dangers in trying to pre-plan things a little bit too much, especially for very, very long projects, I think. So it's good to give yourself a little bit of leeway to explore characters as they develop.
So 3 years you've been working on As the Crow Flies. When did you first come up with the idea? Did you start working on it pretty much around the same time that you came up with the idea for the story? Or was it festering in your head for months or years before you actually began to write it down and turn it into a narrative?
I like that word, festering.
It sits there and it just sort of bugs you for a while, and it starts to fester.
Yeah, the festering actually went on for several years before I actually started drawing the book. Here's a terrible secret of mine that, you know, don't tell the internet. I shouldn't be admitting this on a podcast. I actually tried to draw this book back when I was still in undergrad and had almost no experience drawing comics whatsoever, and it was terrible. There's still pages of this buried on the internet somewhere, and I will not tell you where.
I was just gonna say, we need this exclusive on Comics in Conversation, where we have a link on this podcast to the original release of As the Crow Flies.
No.
Written by 19-year-old Melanie Gilman.
Yeah, Melanie, who was trying to draw the entire book in ballpoint pen, literally, and it was a disaster. But on the plus side, it was a disaster, but it was a disaster that I learned a whole lot from. The version of As the Crow Flies that I'm working on now is probably much better for the fact that I tried to write it and recognized after 40, 50 some pages that this was going nowhere good and I really needed to spend more time honing the plot and working out these characters and figuring out what I actually wanted to say with this story. Even if your first several drafts end up being terrible, there's value in creating them and then just hide them in a drawer and never let anyone see them ever. That's my philosophy.
Yeah, it's always painful to go back and see old things that you either drew or you wrote. One time, actually pretty recently, I was going through a box and found an old box of my college, like all of my college essays and notes and everything. I have no idea how I succeeded in college. They were just terrible. Absolutely terrible. It was frightening.
But at least you can take that as evidence that you have grown significantly.
That's true. That's definitely the way that I'm going to choose to look at it.
Gotta look on the bright side.
Totally. So, colored pencils. As the Crow Flies is drawn all with colored pencils. Why is that? What made you want to use that as your medium?
A combination of reasons. Colored pencil is what I do almost all of my comics in, like probably 99% or so. On some levels, it's just a medium that makes sense to me in an intuitive way. It's a very nitpicky medium. It's a good medium for people who are very detailed oriented and want to control every single aspect of a picture, which I definitely am, the type A people. So it's very good for that. I also knew that I was attracted to the idea of there being something of a more organic look to the pages of this story. There's something kind of warm and comforting to me about the texture of colored pencil itself and the richness of the colors that come out of it. And that was something that felt right for this story. It lends it a kind of warmth and softness that I think might have been lost if I had been trying to do it just in just in pen and ink or in with digital coloring, which is what most cartoonists tend to do. There's also an element of, like, fuck you, I do what I want with it. Not all comics have to be inked.
Right, right. This is partially a rage against the machine.
Yeah.
That is great. That's great. Yeah, it's definitely completely unique. I think this is the only webcomic that I've read personally that's drawn all in color pencil, and it really does lend itself well to the story, I think.
Yeah, there's a very few other cartoonists who do a lot of work in colored pencil. Julie Delpore, I'm probably mispronouncing her name, and I apologize for that. She's a Canadian cartoonist. I think she's living in Montreal now. And she works very frequently in colored pencil. Her style is very different than mine, though. She tends to use her colored pencils almost as if they were pens, using uniform pressure on them and coming up with really thick lines and not quite doing the same amount of detail or level of realism that I put into my work. It's tough to describe the difference, but it looks obvious if you actually look up what she does with her work. It's beautiful, I should say, too. She's using colored pencils in a very different way than I am, but it's still gorgeous work that she's coming up with. So there's a few other people out there, but not too many.
So as the story plot goes, they're at this Christian camp, and they're on this hike, and there's a lot of scenic backdrops to this story, and there's a lot of scenes that are just landscapes that you've drawn out with these colored pencils. How long does it take you to draw one of those landscapes? I mean, there's a lot of those that I've noticed in the comic for sort of several panels or pages in a row where you're focusing on the scenery of the mountain that they're climbing, and it must be time intensive, or do you find those rather quick?
They're definitely time intensive, especially the ones that have like what, like 200 some pine trees and have to draw a visual branch on them. Those definitely take a long time to do. The average time that I spend on a page is usually about 8 to 10 hours just for the drawing parts of it. And part of the reason why it takes that long is it has to do with like level of detail versus the size of the page. My originals are actually very small compared to most cartoonists. They're only about like 8 inches by 10 inches or something like that.
Really?
Maybe even a little bit smaller. Yeah, partially because with colored pencil, every extra square inch that you add means another 20 minutes or so that you're spending on the piece. So it would take me a lot longer if I was working at the size that most cartoonists tend to do their work at. But the nice thing about those, especially the landscape pages, is that they take a long time, but they feel meditative in a way too. You know, I get to just listen to podcasts or audiobooks, and you know, I'll sit outside if I can and just, you know, sit there and draw pine trees for 8 hours. It's actually kind of nice. Not for everybody, understandably, but I actually enjoy it a good bit. And in terms of the narrative too, I think that they are an important part of the piece, because it's important in comics to have those quiet moments. Not in every story, but I think especially for one like this, where it's a little bit more slow building, and especially with a main character like Charlie, who is very she's a very, again, very introverted, very internally focused. It kind of forces the reader to slow down their own reading a little bit and to maybe put themselves a little bit more into her mental space, because you kind of have to look inward and feel a little bit more quiet during those pages. And it's also, you know, for a story about backpacking through the Rocky Mountains, it'd be a crying shame if I didn't spend some time at least trying to capture as much as I can the actual physical beauty of the landscape that they're moving through.
Now, when you were getting started on the comic, what would you say were the biggest roadblocks or challenges that you faced when you were first getting started? Whether it be your own sort of fear or motivation, or, you know, building the website, or knowing, you know, how to move forward. What were the biggest things that sort of stood in your path that stopped you where you were able to share your work?
For me personally, a lot of it was confidence. Whenever you're starting out on a gigantic project, there's a million different things that you know can go wrong. The ones that I was most worried about were things like, I knew that my art style was still developing, that I was still learning, and I was concerned that the early pages would look just incredibly different from the later pages, which is actually true now that I'm 3 years in. That's something which is true of almost every cartoonist. And again, you kind of have to look at it as like, well, here's evidence that you are working hard and improving over time. There was also, because this was such a big story, and because it was a story which I knew had potential to either reach a whole lot of people or I guess possibly offend a whole lot of people. I felt a little bit of trepidation about that, about do I actually want to put myself in a position where I'm, I guess making myself a target in a way is what it felt like. I was worried in some cases that if there was any sort of pushback from this story, if people would freak out about like, how dare you make these accusations about feminism or Christian spaces not being open to queer people and trans people and people of color. So I was a little bit worried about putting myself in that position, especially on the internet where it's impossible to predict how large groups of anonymous strangers will react to your work. Mm-hmm. So there was, most of the blocks ended up being mental blocks, much more so than physical blocks or technical blocks of any sort. When it came down to the actual mechanics of it, like building the website, promoting it, doing things like that. That all came fairly easily. A lot of the struggles, and I think a lot of young writers go through this, is it's more mental, and whether those are completely imagined or actually real worries, it could go either way there. But there's always going to be something. There's always going to be some little niggling voice in your brain which is saying maybe we need to think about this more before we actually go forward with this project, or maybe you need to practice your life drawing for an extra year before you're really ready to get going, or maybe you don't know these characters quite as well as you should before you should start putting pencil to page. But at a certain point, I mean, you can sit there and worry about process, worry about story, worry about character development until the cows come home, and never actually produce a finished page of comics. So at some point, you kind of just need to take that leap of faith and get started on the project, whether or not it's the perfect right moment to do so. Hopefully that answered the question.
That totally answers the question. Thank you. And one thing that you mentioned was, you know, your sort of fear or worry about people responding to your work in a certain way, if they were, you know, if they were Christian, or if they, you know, have some type of ownership over the atmospheres that you were trying to describe. Did you have any experience? Have you had any experience so far where someone has reacted sort of negatively or had a bad opinion of how you were portraying, you know, Christianity or acceptance of queer identities or people of color, anything like that?
And I'm lucky in this regard. I actually haven't had too many like outright mean people show up. The stranger comments that I tend to get are, I get a lot of emails from, particularly from, and this is a very weird audience to be reading this book, from like straight cis white men in their 40s. And I have no idea how they found my work or why they're reading it. But I get a lot of messages from them saying things like, I really thought this story was going to be preachy and I would hate it, but actually it's okay. Or the worst ones are like, I really thought I would hate Charlie as a character, but I guess I don't. And it's like, why? Why do you think that's okay to say? And also, why do you feel the need to write me about this?
Do you respond to those?
I do sometimes. I try to be polite generally, because I don't, with people who are already thinking along those lines, if you tell them that they're full of shit, basically, they're just going to take that as further evidence of like, oh, all these social justice warriors are just angry.
Yeah, they're just looking for something to be mad about.
So I try to respond gently when possible to them, but it still just surprises me so much whenever I get people who write me things like that out of the woodwork, that I'm still not entirely sure what the best course of action to take with them is. But oh well, if they're reading this book, if they're thinking about it on some level, I guess that's a good thing, hopefully, whether or not I actually respond to their emails that they send me.
Are you on the convention scene very often? Do you enjoy conventions? Do you usually attend and meet any fans and have conversations in person?
Absolutely. I love going to conventions. I go to probably far more of them than I should. But conventions are great. I really love getting to talk with other cartoonists, getting to meet people who read the comic, getting to go watch other people speak on panels. There's a million good reasons, especially if you're a young cartoonist, to go to conventions, go there to network with people, to make new friends, to, you know, go and photocopy whatever comics you have and just walk around the tables and trade with people. That was a really important part of me building up my own professional network and, starting to, I hate to use terms like this, build up buzz for my comic. So it's an important part of my career as a cartoonist. It's something which I would definitely recommend to young people who are trying to get started in the field. And it's really fun too. Cartoonists are some of the nicest people that I've ever met. And conventions are usually just this wonderful, fun atmosphere where you're in this, and how often does this happen? You're in a room full of people who are obsessed with independent comics. That's such a rare and beautiful environment. And it's fun to just kind of immerse yourself in that for a weekend at a time. So absolutely, conventions are great. Go to them when you can.
Are there any conventions that you plan to be at coming up soon where people can find you?
Yes. The one that's coming up really soon is I'm going to be down in Austin for Webcomics Rampage. And that is happening it's actually hosted by a local comic shop down there. I think it's called Dragon's Lair. But yes, it's in Austin. It's called Webcomics Rampage. It's coming up, I think, December 8th or 9th, whatever that like first weekend in December is. And it's going to be wonderful. I'm going to be there. Spike is going to be there. Spike of Iron Circus Comics, the woman who publishes Smut Peddler and all those wonderful things. Dax is going to be there. You interviewed them and a whole bunch of different people, too. It's going to be a great show.
Changing gears very briefly, just to ask this question. I ask this question to all the creators who come on the show. Personal question about you. Which kid were you in high school?
I was a member of the super pretentious philosophy club circle. we were the kids who were, you know, hanging out at the back of our AP European history class talking about how only Jean-Paul Sartre understands us. We're like suburban privileged kids. Like, what do we know about anything? But yeah, we're the like clove cigarette smoking Russian literature reading types. I was that kid. I was insufferable.
Funny that you mentioned that sort of. I'm always curious for people who could look back and describe themselves as suburban privileged kid. When did you realize that? Like, it's hard to pinpoint, obviously, but when do you think you can look back and be like, oh, I actually like had it better off than certain people who didn't come from the place that I came from? Or
yeah. It was kind of a rolling realization, and it was a strange one too. My particular situation was a little bit unusual. I came from a split family situation where one family was very wealthy, very very comfortable in all the finances, extremely well-to-do, and the other one was at or below the poverty line for most of my childhood, like to the level of like there would be times when there was literally no food in the house and no money for which to purchase food. So I kind of had a foot in both worlds. But the school district that I was going to was definitely very much so economically privileged suburban white kids. And it probably wasn't until college where I really started to look at that and look at that environment as being a very artificial and also very out of the norm one. Like, not everyone lives this way.
And before we wrap up, you already mentioned some amazing advice to young creators, but I wanted to ask if there was any other advice that you would suggest to someone who was wanting to follow your path and read your comics and want to do something similar to that. Any advice based on your own personal career trajectory and the successes and challenges that you faced that you would want to tell someone else if they wanted to do the same work, same type of work that you do?
Definitely. The absolute best thing that you can do if you're trying to build a career for yourself in comics and webcomics and or even in illustration work too is be very, work really hard and put up everything that you do online. I highly, highly recommend getting in or starting an art Tumblr for yourself if you are a young aspiring cartoonist. And even if, you know, everybody starts at zero followers, that's starting point for everybody, but it tends to grow over time. So the sooner you start that process, the better for your ultimate career. And don't worry about, you know, like, oh no, my art is terrible right now. I don't want to leave a record of this for the internet to see. Don't even worry about it. Everybody grows over time. The important thing is just that you start and start putting your work out there and start getting comfortable with making your work public too. I really do think that that's kind of a skill that people need to learn, is learning how to navigate the emotional feel of putting your work out online and letting complete strangers look at it and comment on it. And
that could be so hard, and I'm glad you mentioned it as a skill. I do feel like it is sort of a skill, sort of self-promotion and being willing to put your work out there to be critiqued by strangers. It's really rough. Yeah. It can be unsettling.
Yeah. Oh gosh, I'm really glad you said self-promotion too. That's the other important thing that I would tell the young creators, is don't be ashamed about self-promotion. A lot of people tend to feel like self-promoting yourself is egotistical, or, you know, if my work was good enough, then other people should be doing the promoting for me. Like, that's not how it works. And it's just something to, everybody knows it's scary and no one likes doing it, try to get yourself used to it. It's another skill to develop there. Don't be afraid to, tell all of your different social media followings when you're doing something new. Post it to Facebook, post it to Twitter, post it to Tumblr. Tell your friends about it. Let people know what you're up to is really the important thing there.
And speaking of self-promotion, just before we wrap up, how can fans of your work support you, or new fans? Maybe they've never read your comics before and they're looking for you on Tumblr or social media or Patreon or Kickstarter. How can someone support your work, Melanie?
I'm all over the place online. I'll just narrow it down to two. If you want to read As the Crow Flies, it's a free webcomic. The whole story up until this point, all 207 some pages, are available on my website, which is melaniegilman.com. That's MelanieGillman.com. And the other one I'll mention, I do have a Patreon, like many cartoonists, and that is patreon.com/mgilman. So if you read As the Crow Flies and would like to throw a couple dollars a month my way to help me cover the cost of materials fees, website hosting fees, things like that, that would be awesome of you.
Thank you so much for joining us on Comics and Conversation, Melanie. This has been really, really great, and I'm so glad that you got nominated for that Eisner. Congratulations on that, and really amazing work on your comic, and I wish you the best working on it in the future as you wrap the story up. I'm excited to finish it.
I'm excited to keep working on it, too. It's the ending's going to be good. I'm not going to tell anybody what it is, but it's going to be good.
No spoilers, but yes, I'm definitely excited to see what happens with the story. Oh, one more thing before we wrap up. What's next after As the Crow Flies? Have you thought that far ahead?
Yes, actually. I'm working on, I'm in the scripting process for the book that I want to do after As the Crow Flies. And it is, the 2 second elevator pitch that I give is, it's a genderqueer retelling of the Persephone myth. So it has a lot to do with, it's a bit more of a supernatural story than As the Crow Flies. It has to do with, there'll be some underworld stuff going on, and focuses more directly on genderqueer and non-binary characters. So it's going to be a lot of fun. If people are interested in that story and watching it develop, I've been posting things like character sketches and scripting information, things like that, to my Patreon, to the secret blog that's attached to it that only backers get to watch. So So if anyone was interested in that, you can kind of watch me as I'm developing my next book in real time through the blog, through my Patreon. So something to look out for if people are interested in.
More reason to support Melanie on Patreon. I'll have the link to her Patreon linked below the podcast, so definitely feel free to check that out and give her your support. Melanie, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate the time for this interview, and it's been a ton of fun. Best of luck for everything that you're doing in the future. I can't wait to read it.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.